Their teeth were snowy and even. None of them had wide bottoms or kangaroo pouches that pulled their slacks out of shape. There was no sign of cellulite, spider veins, or breasts drooping down to their waists. These perfect women lived in well-ordered houses with gleaming floors, an inconceivable array of home appliances, oversized fluffy mutts, and no visible men. I guess Dad was relegated to the office between his woodworking projects. Intellectually, I understood that these were all highly paid models simply posing as housewives for the purpose of selling Kotex, floor covering, and dog food. Their lives were probably as far removed from housewifery as mine was. But what did you do if you actually were a housewife, confronted with all these images of perfection on the hoof? From my perspective, I couldn't see any connection at all between my lifestyle, hookers, death, celibacy, handguns, and fast food, and the lifestyle depicted in the magazine, which was probably just as well. What would I do with a fluffy mutt and containers full of dill and marjoram? "I'm Serena Bonney. Did you want to see me?" I looked up. The nurse in the doorway was in her early 40s, a good-sized woman, maybe 5'10". She wasn't obese by any stretch, but she carried a lot of weight on her frame. The women in her family probably described themselves as hearty peasant stock. I set the magazine aside and got to my feet, holding out my hand. "Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Lorna Kepler's mother hired me to look into her death."
"Again?"
she remarked as she shook my hand. "Actually, the case is still open. Can I take a few minutes of your time?"
"It's a funny hour for an investigation."
"I should apologize for that. I wouldn't ordinarily bother you at work, but I've been suffering insomnia for the last couple of nights, and I thought I might as well take advantage of the fact that you're working."
"I don't really know much, but I'll do what I can. Why don't you come on into the back? It's quiet at the moment, but that may not last long."
We moved past two examining rooms and into a small, sparsely furnished office. Like the nurses upstairs, she was dressed in ordinary street clothes, a white cotton blouse, beige gabardine pants, and a matching vest. The crepe-soled shoes marked her as someone who stood for long hours on her feet. Also, her wristwatch, like a meat thermometer with a sweeping second hand. Serena paused at the doorframe and leaned out into the hall.
"I'll be in here if you need me, Joan."
"No problem," came the reply. Serena left the door ajar, positioning her chair so she could keep an eye on the corridor.
"Sorry you had to wait. I was up on the medical floor. My father was readmitted a couple of days ago, and I try to peek in at him every chance I get."
She had a wide, unlined face and high cheekbones. Her teeth were straight and square, but slightly discolored, perhaps the result of illness or poor nutrition in her youth. Her eyes were light green, her brows pale. "Is his illness serious?" I sat down on a chrome chair with a seat padded in blue tweed.
"He had a massive heart attack a year ago and had a pacemaker put in. He's been having problems with it, and they wanted to check it out. He tends to be a bit obstreperous. He's 75, but very active. He practically runs the Colgate Water Board, and he hates to miss a meeting. He thrives on adrenaline."
"Your father isn't Clark Esselman by any chance."
"You know him?"
"I know his reputation. I had no idea. He's always raising hell with the developers." "He'd been involved in local politics for 15 years, since he'd sold his real estate company and retired in splendor. From what I'd heard, he had a rough temper and a tongue that could shift from saltiness to eloquence, depending on the subject. He was stubborn and outspoken, a respectable board member for a half a dozen charities." She smiled.
"That's him," she said.
She slid a hand through her hair, which was coppery, a cross between red and dark gold. It looked as though she'd had some kind of body permanent, because the curl seemed too pronounced to be entirely natural. The cut was short, the style uncomplicated. I pictured her running a brush through her hair after her morning shower. Her hands were big and her nails blunt cut, but nicely manicured. She spent money on herself, but not in any way that seemed flashy. Suffering illness or injury, I'd have trusted her on sight. I murmured something innocuous and then changed the focus of the conversation.
"What can you tell me about Lorna?" "I didn't know her well. I should probably say that up front." Janice mentioned that you're married to the fellow Lorna worked for at the water treatment plant.
More or less, she said. Roger and I have been separated for about 18 months.
I'll tell you, the last few years have been hellish, to say the least. My marriage fell apart, my father had a heart attack, and then Mother died. After that, Daddy's health problems only got worse. Lorna house sat for me when I needed to get away.
You met her through your husband?
Yes. She worked for Roger for a little over 3 years, so I'd run into her if I popped in at the plant. I'd see her at the employee picnics in the summer and the annual Christmas party. I thought she was fascinating, clearly a lot smarter than the job required.
The two of you got along?
We got along fine.
I paused, wondering how to phrase the question that occurred to me. If it's not too personal, can you tell me about your divorce?
My divorce, she said.
Who filed? Was it you or your husband?
She cocked her head. That's a curious question. What makes you ask?
I was wondering if your separation from Roger had anything to do with Lorna.
Serena's laugh was quick and startled.
Oh, good heavens, no, not at all, she said. We'd been married 10 years, and we both got bored. He was the one who broached the subject, but he certainly didn't get any grief from me. I understood where he was coming from. He feels he has a dead-end job. He likes what he does, but he's never going to get rich. He's one of those guys whose life hasn't quite come up to his expectations. He pictured himself retired by the age of 50. Now he's past that, and he still hasn't got a dime. On the other hand, I not only have a career I'm passionate about, but I'll have family money coming to me one of these days. Living with that got to be too much for him. We're still on friendly terms, we're just not intimate, which you're welcome to verify with him.
I'll take your word for it, I said, though of course I'd check.
What about the house-sitting? How'd Lorna end up doing that?
I don't remember exactly. I probably mentioned in passing that I needed someone. Her place was small and remarkably crude. I thought she'd enjoy spending time in a more comfortable setting.
How often did she sit?
5 or 6 times altogether, I'd guess. She hadn't done it for a while, but Roger thought she was still willing. I could check my calendar at home if it seems relevant.
At the moment, I don't know what's relevant and what's not. Were you satisfied with the job she did?
Sure. She was responsible, fed and walked the dog, watered plants, brought in the newspaper and the mail. It saved me the kennel fees, and I liked having someone in the house while I was gone. After Roger and I split, I moved back into my parents' house. I was interested in a change of scene, and Dad needed some unofficial supervision because of his health. Mother's cancer had already been diagnosed, and she was doing chemo. This was an arrangement that suited all of us.
So, you were living at your father's at the time Lorna died?
That's right. He's been under doctor's care, but he's what they call a non-compliant patient. I had plans to be out of town, and I didn't want him in the house alone. Dad was adamant. He swore he didn't need help, but I insisted. What's the point of a getaway weekend if I'm worried about him the whole time? As a matter of fact, that's what I was trying to set up when I went to her place and found her. I tried calling for days, and there was never any answer. Roger told me she was taking a couple of weeks accrued vacation, but she was due back any day. I wasn't sure when she'd get in, so I thought I'd stop by and leave her a little note. I parked near the cabin, and I was just getting out of my car when I noticed the smell, not to mention the flies.
You knew what it was?
Well, I didn't know it was her, but I knew it was something dead. The odor's quite distinct.
I shifted the subject slightly. Everyone I've interviewed so far has talked about how beautiful she was. I wondered if other women regarded her as a threat.
I never did. Of course, I can't speak for anyone else, she said. Men seemed to find her more appealing than women, but I never saw her flirt. Again, I'm only talking about the occasions when I saw her.
From what I hear, she liked living on the edge, I said.
I introduced the matter without framing a question, interested in what kind of response I might get.
Serena held my gaze, but she made no reply. So far, she'd tended to editorialize on every question I asked.
I ran the query one more round.
Were you aware that she was involved in other activities?
I don't understand the question. What kind of activities are you referring to?
Of a sexual nature.
Ah, that, yes. I assume you're referring to the money she made from the hotel trade. Humping for hire, she said drolly. I didn't think it was my place to bring that up.
Was it common knowledge?
I don't think Roger knew, but I certainly did.
How did you find out?
I'm not sure. I really can't remember. Indirectly, I think. I ran into her at the Edgewater one night. No, wait a minute. I remember what happened. She came into the ER with a broken nose. She had some explanation, but it didn't make much sense. I've seen assault and battery often enough that I wasn't fooled. I didn't say so to her, but I knew something was going on.
Could it have been a boyfriend? Someone she was living with?
I could hear voices in the hallway. She glanced over at the door. I guess it could have been, but as far as I knew, she was never in any kind of steady relationship. Anyway, the story she told seemed suspect. I've forgotten what it was now, but it seemed phony as hell. And it wasn't just the broken nose. It was that in conjunction with some other things.
Such as?
Her wardrobe, her jewelry. She was subtle about it, but I couldn't help noticing.
When was the incident that brought her to the emergency room?
I don't remember exactly. Probably 2 years ago. Check with medical records. They can give you the date.
You don't know hospitals. I'd have better luck getting access to state secrets, I said.
A baby had begun to cry fretfully in the waiting room.
Does it make a difference?
It might. Suppose the guy who punched her decided to make it permanent.
Oh, I see your point.
Serena's eyes strayed to the open door again as Joan went past.
But she didn't confide in you when she came in?
Not at all. After I saw her at the Edgewater, I put two and two together.
Seems like a bit of a leap.
Not if you'd seen her the night I ran into her. Part of it, too, was the guy she was with. Older, very slick. Gold jewelry, gorgeous suit. Clearly a man who had money to burn. I saw them in the bar and later in the boutique where she was trying on clothes. He dropped a bundle that night. 4 Escada outfits, and she was modeling a 5th.
I assume Escada is expensive.
Dear God, she laughed, patting herself on the chest. Lights were going on in the examining cubicle across from us. I could hear the murmuring of voices. Fussy baby, shrill mom speaking rapid-fire Spanish. Serena went on.
It happened again within the month, as I remember. Same situation, different guy, same look. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out.
You think one of these guys knocked her around?
I think it's a better explanation than the one she gave. I'm not saying this is always true, but some guys in that age bracket start having trouble with impotency. They pick up high-priced call girls and spread the money around. Champagne and gifts, a gorgeous babe in tow. It looks good on the surface, and everybody thinks what a stud he is. What these men are looking for is a one-up relationship because they can't get it up any other way. He's paying for the service, so if the equipment doesn't work, it's her fault, not his, and he can express his disappointment any way he likes.
With his fist.
If you want to look at it from his point of view, why not? He's paid for her, she's his. If he can't perform, he's got her to blame, and he can paste her in the chops.
Some deal. She keeps the cash and the clothes in exchange for the punishment.
She doesn't always get punished. Some of these guys like to be punished themselves. Beaten, humiliated. They like to have their little fannies spanked for being bad, bad, bad.
Did Lorna tell you this?
No, but I've heard it from a couple of other hookers on the local circuit. I also did some reading on the subject when I was getting my degree. I used to see them come in, and I'd be incensed at the way they were treated, furious because I didn't really understand what was going on. I jumped to the rescue, trying to save them from the bad guys. For all the good that did. In an odd way, I'm a better nurse if I can stay detached.
And that's what you did with her?
Exactly. I felt compassion, but I didn't try to fix her. It was none of my business. And she didn't see it as a problem, at least as far as I knew.
You seem to spend a lot of time at the Edgewater. Is that where the singles hang out these days?
The singles in our age group, yes. I'm sure the kids would find it stuffy beyond belief, and the price is astronomical. Frankly, it makes married life look pretty good.
Do you happen to remember any dates when you saw her? If I check with the hotel, it helps to pin it down.
She thought about that briefly. Once I was with a bunch of girlfriends. We get together to celebrate birthdays. That time it was mine, so it must have been early in March. We don't always manage to get together on the exact date, but it would have been a Friday or Saturday because that's when we play.
That was last March?
Must have been.
Was this before the broken nose or afterward?
I have no idea.
Did Lorna know you knew?
Well, she saw me that night, and maybe twice before that. Since Roger and I had separated, I was out with friends almost every weekend. Lorna and I didn't come right out and discuss her career, but there were veiled references.
Serena had used the fingers of both hands to form the quote marks around the word career.
I'm just curious, how do you happen to remember in such detail? Most people can't recall what happened yesterday.
The police asked me most of this, and it stuck in my mind. Also, I've given it a lot of thought. I don't have a clue why she was murdered, and it bothers me.
You believe she was murdered?
I think it's likely, yes.
Were you aware that she was involved in pornography?
Serena frowned slightly.
In what way?
She starred in a video. Someone sent the cassette to her parents about a month ago.
What was it? Like a snuff film? S&M?
No, it was fairly pedestrian in terms of the story and subject matter, but Mrs. Kepler suspects it may be linked to Lorna's death.
Do you?
I'm not being paid to have opinions at this point. I like to keep my options open.
I understand, she said. It's like making a diagnosis. No point in ruling out the obvious.
There was a knock at the doorframe, and Joan peered in. Sorry to interrupt, but we've got a baby over here I'd like you to take a look at. I've got a call into the resident, but I think you should see him.
Serena rose to her feet.
Let me know if there's anything else, she said to me as she moved toward the door.
I'll do that, and thanks. I drove back to my place through deserted streets. I was beginning to feel at home in the late-night world. The nature of the darkness shifts from hour to hour. Once the bars close down and traffic dissipates, what emerges is the utter stillness of 3 a.m. The intersections are empty. Traffic lights are bright O's of red and seafoam green in a dazzling string that you can see for half a mile. Clouds were pouring in. A dense ground fog, like cotton batting, was laid across the mountains, and the gray hills were pocked with street lights against the backdrop of rolling mist. Most of the residential windows I saw were dark. Where an occasional light burned, I pictured students churning out last-minute papers, the nightmares of the young. Or maybe the lights burned for recent insomniacs like me. A police car cruised slowly along Cabana Boulevard, the uniformed officer turning to stare at me as I passed. I took a left onto my street and found a parking place. I locked the car. The sky was velvety with clouds now, the stars completely obscured. Darkness hugged the ground while the sky was tinged with eerie light, like dark gray construction paper smudged with white chalk. Behind me, I heard the low hum of air moving swiftly through the spokes of a bike. I turned in time to see the man on the bicycle passing. From the rear, his taillight and the strips of reflecting tape on his heels made him look like someone juggling three small points of light. The effect was oddly unsettling, a circus act of the spirits performed solely for me. I went through the gate and let myself into my apartment, flipping on the light. Everything was orderly, just as I'd left it. The quiet was profound. I could feel a little nudge of anxiety, made up of weariness, the late hour, empty rooms around me. I wasn't going to be able to sleep at this point. It was like hunger. Once the peak moment passed, the appetite diminished and you could simply do without. Food, sleep, what difference did it make? The metabolism shifts into overdrive, calling up energy from some other source. If I'd gone to bed at 9 or even 10 o'clock, I could have slept through the night. But now my sleep permit had reached its expiration point. Having stayed awake this long, I was consigned to further wakefulness. My body was both fatigued and fired up. I dropped my handbag and jacket on the chair by the door. I glanced at the answering machine. No messages. Did I have any wine on the premises? No, I did not. I checked the contents of the refrigerator, which showed nothing of culinary interest. My pantry was typically barren, a few stray cans and dried items that, singly or in combination, would never constitute anything remotely edible, unless you favored uncooked lentils with maple syrup. The peanut butter jar had concentric swirl marks in the bottom, as if the rest of it had drained away. I found a kitchen knife and scraped the sides of the jar, eating the accumulated peanut butter off the blade as I walked around. "This is really pitiful," I said, laughing, but actually I didn't mind a bit. Idly, I flipped on the TV set. Lorna's video was still in the VCR. I touched the remote control, and the tape began to run again. I had no intention of watching any late-night sex, but I went through the credits twice. The night before, I'd tried directory assistance in San Francisco, hoping for a telephone number for the production company Cyrenaic Cinema. In the credits, the producer, director, and film editor were all listed by name: Joseph Ayers, Morton Castlebaum, and Chester Ellis, respectively. What the hell? Telephone operators are awake all night. I tried the names in reverse order, bombing out on the first two. When I got to the producer, I picked up a hit. The operator sang, "Thank you for using AT&T," and a recording kicked in. A mechanical voice came on the line and recited Joseph Ayers' number for me, twice. I made a note, then picked up the phone and called directory assistance in San Francisco again, this time checking for a listing in the names of the other players, Russell Turpin and Nancy Dobbs. She wasn't listed, but there were two Turpins with the first initial R, one on Haight and one on Greenwich. I wrote down both numbers. At the risk of wasting my time and Janice Kepler's money, a trip north might actually be worth a shot. If the contacts didn't pan out, at least there was hope of eliminating the porno angle as a factor in her daughter's death. I put a call through to Frankie's coffee shop, and Janice answered on the second ring. "Janice, this is Kinsey. I have a question for you." She said, "Fire away. We're not busy." I brought her up to date on my conversations with Lieutenant Dolan and Serena Bonney, and then filled her in on the mini-survey I'd done of the pornographic film crew. "I think it might be worthwhile to talk to the producer and the other actor." "I remember him," she cut in. "Yeah, well, between Turpin and this film producer, I'm hoping we can satisfy some questions. I'll try to contact both by phone in advance, but it looks like it'd make sense to make a quick trip. If I can set up a few appointments, I thought I'd hit the road."
"You're going to drive?"
"I'd thought to."
"Don't you have a dinky little VW? Why not fly? I would if I were you."
"I guess I could," I said dubiously. "On a short hop like that, though, the plane fare will be outrageous. I'll have to rent a car up there, too. Motel, meals."
"That sounds okay to me. Just save your receipts, and we'll reimburse you when you get back."
"What about Mace? Did you tell him about the tape?"
"Well, I told you I would. He was shocked, of course, and then he got mad as hell. Not with her, but whoever put her up to it."
"What's his feeling about the investigation itself? He didn't seem that thrilled yesterday."
"He told me just what he told you," she said. "If this is what it takes to make me happy, he'll go along with it."
"Great. I'll probably fly up sometime tomorrow afternoon and talk to you as soon as I get back."
"Have a good flight," she said.
Chapter 9. At 9 o'clock the next morning, I roused myself just long enough to call Ida Ruth, telling her I'd be in shortly in case anyone was looking for me. As I pulled the covers up, I checked the plexiglass skylight above my bed. Clear, sunny skies, probably 65 degrees outside. To hell with the run. I awarded myself 10 more minutes of rest. I next woke at 12:37, feeling as hungover as if I'd drunk myself insensible the night before. The tricky factor with sleep is that aside from the number of hours you put in, the body seems to hold you accountable for their position. Snoozing from 4 a.m. to 11 a.m. doesn't necessarily equate with the same number of hours logged between 11 p.m. and 6. I had sketched in a full 7, but my regular metabolic rhythms were now decidedly off and required additional downtime to correct themselves. I called Ida Ruth again and was relieved to discover she was out at lunch. I left a message indicating I'd been delayed by a meeting with a client. Don't ask why I fib to a woman who doesn't even cut my paycheck. Sometimes I lie just to keep my skills up. I staggered out of bed and into the bathroom where I brushed my teeth. I felt as if I'd been anesthetized, and I was sure that none of my extremities would function. I propped myself against the wall in the shower, hoping the hydrotherapy would mend my skewed circuits. Once dressed, I found myself eating breakfast at 1 in the afternoon, wondering if I'd ever get myself back on track again. I put on a pot of coffee and dosed myself with caffeine while I made some phone calls to San Francisco. I didn't get very far. Instead of Joseph Ayers, I got an answering machine that may or may not have been his. It was one of those carefully worded messages that bypasses confirmation of the party's name or the number called. A mechanical male voice said, "Sorry I wasn't here to take your call, but if you'll leave your name, number, and a brief message, I'll get back to you." I left my name and office number, and then left messages on answering machines for both R. Turpins. One voice was female, the other male. To both Turpins, I chattered happily. "I'm not sure if this is the right Turpin or not. I'm looking for Russell. I'm a friend of Lorna Kepler's. She suggested I call if I was ever in San Francisco, and since I'm going to be up there in the next couple of days, I thought I'd say hi. Give me a call when you get this message. I'd love to meet you. She spoke so highly of you. Thanks." Through San Francisco information, I checked out the names of other members of the crew, working my way patiently down the list. Most were disconnects. As long as I was home, I opened my desk drawer and pulled out a fresh pack of index cards, transcribing the information I'd picked up on the case to date, about 4 cards worth. Over the last several years, I've developed the habit of using index cards to record the facts uncovered in the course of an investigation. I pin the cards on the bulletin board that hangs above my desk, and in idle moments I arrange and rearrange the data according to no known plan. At some point I realized how different a detail can look when it's seen out of context. Like the pieces in a jigsaw puzzle, the shape of reality seems to shift according to circumstance. What seems strange or unusual can make perfect sense when it's placed in the proper setting. By the same token, what seems unremarkable can suddenly yield up precious secrets when placed against a different backdrop. The system, I confess, usually nets me absolutely nothing, but a payoff comes along just often enough to warrant continuing. Besides, it's restful, it keeps me organized, and it's a visual reminder of the job at hand. I pinned Lorna's photograph on the board beside the cards. She looked back at me levelly with calm hazel eyes and that enigmatic smile. Her dark hair was pulled smoothly away from her face. Slim and elegant, she leaned against the wall with her hands in her pockets. I studied her, as if she might reveal what she had learned in the last minutes of her life. With the silence of a cat, she returned my gaze. Time to get in touch with Lorna's day self, I thought. I drove along the 2-lane asphalt road, past the low, rolling fields of dry grass, drab green overlaid with gold. Here and there the live oaks appeared in dark green clumps. The day was darkly overcast, the sky a strange blend of charcoal and sulfur-yellow clouds. The swell of mountains in the distance were a hazy blue, sandstone escarpments visible across the face. This section of Santa Teresa County is basically desert, the soil better suited for chaparral and sage scrub than productive crops. The early settlers in the area planted all the trees. The once sere land has now been softened and civilized, but there is still the aura of harsh sunlight on newly cultivated ground. Take away the irrigation systems, the drip hoses and the sprinklers, and the vegetation would revert to its natural state. Ceanothus, coyote brush, manzanita, and rolling grasses that in dry years yield a harvest of flames. If current predictions were correct and we were entering another drought, all the foliage would turn to tinder, and the land would be cleared beneath a plow of fire. Up ahead on the left was the Santa Teresa Water Treatment Plant, erected in the 1960s. Red tile roof, 3 white stucco arches, and a few small trees. Beyond the low lines of the building, I caught sight of the maze of railings that surrounded concrete basins. To my right, a sign indicated the presence of the Largo Reservoir, though the body of water wasn't visible from the road. I parked out in front and went up the concrete stairs and through the double glass doors.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
I parked out in front and went up the concrete stairs and through the double glass doors. The reception desk sat to the left of the front entrance, which opened into a big room that apparently doubled as class space. The clerk at the desk must have been Lorna's replacement. She looked young and capable, without a hint of Lorna's beauty. The brass plate on her desk indicated that her name was Melinda Ortiz. I gave her my business card by way of introduction. "Could I have a few minutes with the plant supervisor?"
"That's his truck behind you. He just arrived."
I turned in time to see a county truck turn into the driveway. Roger Bonney emerged and headed in our direction with the preoccupied air of someone on his way to a meeting, focus already leapfrogging to the encounter to come.
"Can I tell him what this is in regards to?"
I looked back at her. "Lorna Kepler."
"Oh, her. That was awful."
"Did you know her?"
She shook her head. "I've heard people talk about her, but I never met her myself. I've only been here 2 months. She had this job before the girl I replaced. There might have been one more in between. Mr. Bonney had to go through quite a few after her."
"You're part-time?"
"Afternoons. I got little kids at home, so this is perfect for me. My husband works nights, so he can keep 'em while I'm gone."
Bonney entered the reception area, manila envelope in hand. He had a broad face, very tanned, tousled curly hair that had probably turned gray when he was 25. The combination of lines and creases in his face had an appealing effect. He might have been too handsome in his youth, the kind of man whose looks make me surly and unresponsive. My second husband was beautiful, and that relationship had come to a demoralizing end, at least from my perspective. Daniel seemed to think everything was just swell, thanks. I was inclined now to disconnect from certain male types. I like a face marked by the softening process of maturity. A few sags and bags are reassuring somehow. Bonney caught sight of me and paused politely at Melinda's desk, lest he interrupt our conversation. She showed him my card.
"She asked to see you. It's about Lorna Kepler."
His gaze leapt to mine. The brown eyes were unexpected. With silver-gray hair and his fair coloring, I'd imagined blue. "I'll be happy to make an appointment for later if this is not convenient," I said. He looked at his watch. "I have the annual State Health Services inspection in about 15 minutes, but you're welcome to come with me while I walk the plant. Shouldn't take long. I like to satisfy myself everything's in order before they come."
"That'd be great."
I followed him down a short corridor to the left, pausing while he stopped in his office and dropped the envelope on his desk. He wore a pale blue dress shirt, collar unbuttoned, tie askew, stone-washed blue jeans, and heavy work boots. With a hard hat and clipboard, you could place him at a construction site and mistake him for an engineer. He was a little under 6 feet tall, and he'd picked up the substantial look of a man in his mid-50s. He wasn't fat by any means, but he was broad across the shoulders and heavy through the chest. My guess was that he controlled his weight now with constant exercise, probably tennis and golf, with an occasional fierce game of racquetball. He didn't have the lean muscle mass of a long-distance runner, and he somehow struck me as the sort who'd prefer competition while he kept himself in shape. I pictured him playing high school football, which in 10 more years would inspire his joints to disintegrate. I followed on his heels as we started off again. "I appreciate your talking to me on such short notice."
"It's no problem," he said. "Ever had a tour of the water treatment plant?"
"I never even knew it was here."
"We like to educate the public."
"In case the rates go up again, I'll bet." He smiled good-naturedly as we pushed through a heavy door.
"You want the spiel or not?"
"Absolutely."
"I was sure you would," he said. "Water from the reservoir across the road comes through the intake structure, passing under the floor of the reception area. You might have been aware of it if you'd known what to listen for. Fish screens and trash racks minimize the entry of foreign material. Water comes down through here. Big channel runs under this part of the building. We're about to shut down for a maintenance inspection in the next few days."
In the area we passed, a series of gauges and meters tracked the progress of the water, which was pouring through the facility with a low-level hum. The floors were concrete, and the pipes, in a tangled grid across the wall, were painted pink, dark green, brown, and blue, with arrows pointing in 4 directions. A floor panel had been removed, and Bonnie pointed downward without a word. I peered into the hole. Down about 4 feet, I could see black water moving blindly through the channel like a mole. The hair along my arm seemed to crawl in response. There was no way to tell just how deep it was or what might be undulating in its depths. I stepped away from the hole, picturing a long, suckered tentacle whipping out to grab my foot and drag me in. I'm nothing if not suggestible. A door closed behind us with a hollow clank, and I was forced to suppress a shriek. Bonnie didn't seem to notice. "When did you last talk to Lorna?" I asked.
"Friday morning, April 20th," he said. "I remember because I had a golf tournament that weekend, and I was hoping to leave work early and get out to the driving range. She was doing it one, but she phoned and said she was suffering a real bad allergy attack. She was trying to get out of town anyway, you know, to find some relief from the pollen count, so I told her to go ahead and take the day off. There wasn't any point having her come in if she was feeling punk. According to the police, she died the next day."
"So she was supposed to be back at work May 7th?
"I'd have to check the date. It would have been 2 weeks from Monday, and they'd found her by then."
He reverted back to tour guide mode, talking about construction costs as we entered the next section of the plant. The low hum of rushing water and the smell of chlorine created an altered awareness. The general air of the place was of backwash valves and pressurized tanks on the verge of exploding. It looked as though one good jolt from the San Andreas Fault and the whole facility would collapse, spewing forth billions of gallons of water and debris, which would kill both of us in seconds. I edged up closer to him, feigning an interest I didn't quite feel. When I tuned in again, he was saying,
"The water is pre-chlorinated to kill disease-causing organisms. Then we add coagulants, which cause the fine particles to clump together. Polymers are generally added in the coagulation process to improve the formation of insoluble flocks that can then be filtered out. We have a lab in the back so we can monitor the water quality."
Oh, great. Now I had to worry about disease-causing organisms on the loose in the lab. Drinking water used to be such a simple matter for me. Get a glass, turn the tap on, fill water to the brim, and gulp it down until you burped. I never thought about insoluble flock or coagulants. Barf! Simultaneous with his explanation of the plant operation, which he must have done 100 times in the past, I could see him scrutinize every inch of the place in preparation for the upcoming inspection. We clattered down a short flight of concrete steps and through a door to the outside. The day seemed curiously bright after the artificial light inside, and the damp air was perfumed with chemicals. Long walkways ran between blocks of open basins, surrounded by metal railings, where still water sat as calm as glass, reflecting gray sky and the underside of the concrete grids.
"These are the flocculation and coagulation basins. The water's kept circulating to create a flock of good size and density for later removal in the sedimentation basins."
I was saying, and "uh-huh" type things. He talked on, taking the whole process for granted. What I was looking at, trying not to register my profound distaste, were still troughs where water sat with a viscous-looking liquid on its surface, bubble-coated and inky. The sludge was as black as licorice and looked as if it were made up of melted tires just coming to the boil. Perversely, I pictured a plunge into the tarry depths, wondering if you'd flail to the surface with your flesh in tatters from all the chemicals. Steven Spielberg could have a ball with this stuff.
"You're not with the police department?" he asked.
He hadn't stopped walking once. "I was, once upon a time. Temperamentally, I'm better suited to the private sector." I was trotting at his heels like a kid on a field trip, irretrievably separated from the rest of the class. Out the backside of the plant, there was a wide, shallow reservoir of cracked black sediment, like a thawing pond of crud. Thousands of years from now, anthropologists would dig this up and imagine it was some kind of sacrificial basin. He asked,
"Are you allowed to say who you're working for, or is that privileged information?"
"Lorna's parents," I said. "Sometimes I prefer not to give out the information, but in this case it's a straightforward matter, no big secret. I had the same conversation with Serena last night."
"My soon-to-be ex? Well, that's an interesting point of departure. Why her? Because she found the body?"
"That's right. I couldn't get to sleep. I knew she worked the night shift at St. Terry's, so I thought I might as well talk to her first. If I thought you were up, I'd have knocked on your door as well.
Enterprising, he remarked.
I'm getting paid $50 an hour for this. Makes sense to work every chance I get.
How's it going so far?
Right now, I'm at the information-gathering phase, trying to get a feel for what I'm dealing with. I understand Lorna worked for you for, what, 3 years?
About that. Originally, the job was full-time, but with the budget cuts, we decided we'd try getting by with 20 hours a week. So far, it's been fine. Not ideal, but doable. Lorna was taking classes over at City College, and the part-time employment really suited her schedule.
By now, we'd circled back through the plant on some subterranean level. The entire underground space was dominated by massive pipes. We went up a long flight of stairs and suddenly emerged into a well-lighted corridor not that far from his office. He showed me in and indicated a chair.
Have a seat.
You have time?
Let's cover what we can, and what we don't have time for, we can try another day.
He leaned over and pressed the button on his intercom.
Melinda, buzz me if I'm not out there when the inspectors arrive.
I heard a muffled, "Yes, sir."
Sorry for the interruption. Go ahead, he said.
No problem. Was Lorna good at the job?
I had no complaints. The work itself didn't amount to much. She was largely a receptionist.
Did you know much about her personal life?
Yes and no. Actually, in a facility like ours, where you have less than 20 employees on any given shift, we get to know each other pretty well. We're in operation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so this is family to me. I have to say Lorna was a little bit standoffish. She wasn't rude or cold, but she was definitely reserved. Break time, she always seemed to have her nose in a book. Brought a sack lunch, sometimes sat out in her car to eat. She didn't volunteer a lot of information. She'd answer if you asked, but she wasn't forthcoming.
People have described her as secretive. He made a face at the term.
I wouldn't say that. Secretive has a sinister implication to my way of thinking. She was pleasant, but somewhat aloof. The term restrained might be apt.
How would you describe your relationship with her?
My relationship?
Yes, I'm wondering if you ever saw her outside of work. His laugh seemed embarrassed.
If you mean what I think, I have to say I'm flattered, but she was strictly an employee. She was a good-looking girl, but she was, what, 24 years old?
25.
And I'm twice that. Believe me, Lorna had no interest in a man my age.
Why not? You're nice-looking, and you seem personable.
I appreciate your vote, but it doesn't mean much to a girl in her position. She was probably looking for marriage and a family. Last thing in the world I have any interest in. In her eyes, I'd have been a slightly overweight old turd. Besides, the women I date, I like to have shared interests and intelligent conversation. Lorna was bright, but she never even heard of the Tet Offensive, and the only Kennedy she knew about were Carolyn and John John.
Just a possibility, I remarked. I broached the same subject with Serena, wondering if Lorna was in any way associated with your divorce.
Not at all. My marriage to Serena simply ran out of juice. Sometimes I think dissension would have been an improvement. Conflict has some spark to it. What we had was flat.
Serena says you wanted the divorce.
Well, that's true, he said. But I've bent over backward to keep things friendly. It's like I said to my attorney, I feel guilty enough as it is, so let's not make matters worse. I love Serena. She's a hell of a nice gal, and I think the world of her. I'm just not ready to live without passion. I'd have to hope she represented the situation much in the same light.
Actually, she did, I said. But I thought it was worth exploring in the context of Lorna's death.
I understand. Of course, I was sorry as hell when I found out what happened to her. She was honest, she was prompt, and as far as I know, she got along with everyone.
I saw him ease a look at his watch under the pretext of adjusting the band. I stirred on my chair. I better let you go, I said. I can see you're distracted.
I guess I am, now that you mention it. I hope you don't think I'm rude.
Not at all. I appreciate your time. I have to be out of town in the next couple of days, but I may get back to you if that's okay.
Of course. I'm sometimes hard to reach, but you can check with Melinda. We'll be closing down for maintenance and repairs on Saturday, so I'll be here if you need me then.
I'll keep that in mind. In the meantime, if you think of anything pertinent, could you give me a call?
Certainly, he said.
I left another business card. We shook hands across the desk, and then he walked me out. Two inspectors were waiting by Melinda's desk. The guy wore a dress shirt, jeans, and tennis shoes. I noticed the woman inspector was dressed a lot better. Roger greeted them pleasantly, giving me a quick wave as he ushered them down the hall. I drove to my office. It was mid-afternoon, and faint rays of winter sun were pushing through the overcast. The sky was white, the grass a vivid shade of lime green. February comes to Santa Teresa in a tumble of hot pink geraniums, magenta bougainvillea, and orange nasturtiums. I was accustomed to functioning in the dark by now, and the light seemed harsh, the colors too glaring. Night seemed softer, like a liquid that surrounded everything, cool and soothing. At night, all the foliage was blended by shadow, fused and simplified. Where daylight divided, setting objects in sharp contrast, at war with one another. I let myself in the side entrance and then sat at my desk, shifting papers around, trying to behave as if I had some purpose. I was too tired to socialize, and the lack of sleep was recreating the sensation of being stoned. I felt as if I'd been smoking dope for the last 2 days. All my energy had seeped away, like sawdust leaking out through a hole in my shoe. At the same time, the infusion of coffee was causing a crackling sound in the center of my brain, like an antenna picking up radio signals from outer space. Any minute now, Venusians would send warnings of the forthcoming invasion, and I'd be too out of it to call the police. I laid my head down on my desk and sank into unconsciousness. An hour and 5 minutes into the nap to end all naps, the telephone rang. The sound cut through me like a chainsaw. I jumped as if goosed. I snatched up the receiver and identified myself, trying to sound as though I were wide awake.
"Miss Milhone? This is Joe Ayers. What can I do for you?"
I couldn't think who the hell he was. "Mr. Ayers, I appreciate the call," I said enthusiastically. "Hang on 1 second." I put my hand across the mouthpiece. Joe Ayers. Joseph Ayers. Ah, the pornographic film producer. I shifted the phone to the other ear so I could make notes as we chatted. I understand you were the producer of an art movie in which Lorna Kepler appeared.
That's correct.
Can you tell me about her involvement in the project?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
I guess I'm not either. Someone sent a video to her mother, and she asked me what I could find out. I noticed your name listed as the producer. Ayers cut in brusquely.
Miss Milhone, you're going to have to fill me in here. We have nothing to discuss. Lorna Kepler was murdered 6 months ago.
It was actually 10 months ago. I'm aware of that. Her parents are hoping to develop additional information. I was sounding pompous even to my own ears, but his irritation was irritating.
Well, you're not going to develop anything from me, he said. I wish I could help, but my contact with Lorna was extremely limited. Sorry, I can't help you.
I checked my notes in haste, trying to talk fast enough to snag his interest. What about the other two actors who were in the film with her, Nancy Dobbs and Russell Turpin? I could hear him shift with annoyance.
What about them?
I'd like to talk to them. Silence.
I can probably tell you how to get to him, he said finally.
You have a current address and telephone number?
I should have it somewhere.
I heard him snapping through the pages of what I guessed was his address book. I tucked the phone in the crook of my neck and uncapped my pen.
Here we go, he said.
He rattled out the information, which I made a note of. The Haight Street address corresponded with the one I'd picked up from directory assistance. I said, This is terrific. I appreciate this. What about Miss Dobbs?
Can't help you there.
Look, can you tell me what your schedule is for the next couple of days?
What does my schedule have to do with it?
I was hoping we could meet. Through the phone, I could hear his brain cells whirring as he processed the request.
I really don't see the point. I hardly knew Lorna. I might have been in her company 4 days at best.
Can you remember when you last saw her?
No. I know I never saw her after the shoot, and that'd be a year ago December. That was the one and only time we ever did business together. Matter of fact, that film was never even put in release, so I had no reason to contact her afterward.
Why wasn't the film released?
I don't think that's any of your concern. What is it? Some kind of secret? It's not secret. It's just none of your business.
That's too bad. I was hoping you could give us some help.
Miss Milhone, I don't even really know who you are. You call me up, leave a message on my machine with an area code I don't even recognize. You could be anyone. Why the hell should I help you?
Right. You're right. You don't know me from Adam, and there's no way I can compel you to give me information. I'm down in Santa Teresa, an hour away by plane. I don't want anything in particular from you, Mr. Ayers. I'm just doing what I can to try to figure out what happened to Lorna, and I'd appreciate some background. I can't force you to cooperate.
It's not a question of cooperation. I have nothing to contribute, truly.
I probably wouldn't even take an hour of your time. I could hear him breathing while he took this in. I half expected him to hang up. Instead, his tone became wary.
You're not trying to break into the business, are you?
The business? I thought he was referring to the private eye trade.
Because if you're some kind of bullshit actress, you're wasting your time. I don't care how big your tits are.
I assure you I'm not. This is strictly legitimate. You can verify my credentials with the Santa Teresa police.
You couldn't have caught me at a worse time. I just flew back from 6 weeks in Europe. My wife's having some kind of goddamn shindig I'm supposed to attend tonight. She's shelling out a fortune, and I don't know half the people she's invited. I'm dead on my feet as it is.
What about tomorrow?
That's even worse. I've got business to take care of.
Tonight, then? I can probably be there in a couple of hours. He was silent, but his annoyance was palpable.
Ah, shit. All right, what the hell, he said. If you actually fly up, you can give me a call. If I feel up to it, I'll see you. If not, too bad. That's the best I can do, and I'll probably regret it.
That's great. That's fine. Can I reach you at the same number? He sighed, probably counting to 10. I'd irritated him so desperately we were almost friends.
Here's the number at the house. I might as well give you the address while I'm at it. You sound like you can be very obnoxious if you don't get what you want.
I'm terrible, I said. He gave me his home address.
I'm going to bed, he said.
I heard the phone bang down. I put a call through to my travel agent, Lupe, and asked for reservations on the next flight out. As it happened, everything was booked until 9 o'clock. She put me on standby status and told me to get on out to the airport. I went back to my place and flung a few items in a duffel bag. At the last minute, I remembered I hadn't told Ida Ruth where I'd be. I called her at home. Here's what she said when she heard I was flying to San Francisco.
Well, I hope you're wearing something better than jeans and a turtleneck.
Ida Ruth, I'm insulted. This is business, I said.
Uh-huh.
Look down and describe what you have on. On second thought, don't bother. I'm sure you look stunning. You want to give me a number where you can be reached?
I don't know where I'll be staying. I'll call when I get there and let you know.
Leave it on the office machine. I'll be in bed by the time you get to San Francisco, she said.
You be careful.
Yes, ma'am, I promise.
Take some vitamins.
I will. See you when I get back, I said. I tidied my apartment in case the plane went down, taking out the trash as a parting gesture to the gods. As we all know, the day I neglect this important ritual, the plane will auger in and everyone will think what a slob I was. Besides, I like order on the premises. Coming home from a trip, I like to be greeted with serenity, not sloppiness. Chapter 10. When I got to the airport, I left the VW in long-term parking and hiked back to the terminal. Like most public buildings in Santa Teresa, the airport is vaguely Spanish in appearance. 1.5 stories of white stucco with a red tile roof, arches, and a curving stairway up the side. Inside the terminal, there are only 5 departure gates, with a tiny newsstand on the first floor and a modest coffee shop on the second. At the United counter, I picked up my ticket and gave my name to the agent in case a seat opened up on an earlier plane. No such luck. I found a seat nearby, propped my head on my fist, and snoozed like a vagrant until my flight was called. In the time I waited, I could have driven to San Francisco. The plane was a little putt-putt with 15 seats, 10 of which were occupied. I turned my attention to the glossy airline magazine tucked in the seat pouch in front of me. This was my complimentary copy. It said so right on the front. The term complimentary meaning way too boring to spend real money on.
While the engines were being revved up with all the high whine of racing mopeds, the flight attendant recited last rites. We couldn't hear a word she was saying, but the way her mouth was moving, we got the general idea. We took off with the aircraft bucking and shuddering, the flight smoothing out abruptly as we reached altitude. The attendant made her way down the aisle with a tray, dispensing clear plastic cups full of orange juice or Coca-Cola, and childproof packets of, choose one, pretzels or peanuts. The airlines, extremely cunning at trimming costs these days, have now reduced the serving size of these peanuts to, approximately, 1 tablespoon per person. I broke each of mine in half, eating one piece at a time to prolong the experience. As we droned up the coast through the night-blackened sky, communities below us appeared as a series of patchy, disconnected lights. At that altitude, the towns looked like isolated colonies on an alien planet, with dark stretches between what by day would be mountains. I was disoriented by the landscape. I tried to pick out Santa Maria, Paso Robles, and King City, but I had no clear sense of size or distances. I could see the 101, but the highway looked eerie and unfamiliar at that remove. We reached San Francisco in a little under an hour and a half. Coming in, I could see the streetlights undulate across the hills, tracing the terrain like a contour map. We touched down at a commuter terminal so remote that a progression of ground agents had to be stationed along the tarmac to point us to civilization. We went into the building, up the back stairs like immigration deportees, and finally emerged into a familiar corridor. I stopped off at a newsstand and bought myself a decent city map, then found the rental car counter, where I filled out all the paperwork. By 11:05, I was on the 101, heading north toward the city. The night was clear and cold, the lights of Oakland and Alameda visible to my right across the bay. Traffic moved swiftly, and the city began to take shape around me like a neon confection. Half a mile past Market Street, at Golden Gate Avenue, the 101 dwindled down to a surface road. I drove the short half-block to Van Ness and turned left, eventually taking another left onto Lombard. Coffee shops and motels of every size and description lined both sides of the four-lane thoroughfare. Not wanting to devote unnecessary energy to the project, I checked into the Del Rey Motel at the first vacant sign. I would only be there one night. All I needed was a room clean enough that I wouldn't be forced to wear shoes at all times. I asked for accommodations away from the traffic noise and was directed to 343 at the back. The Del Rey was one of those motels where the management assumes you're going to steal everything in sight. All the coat hangers were designed so the hooks couldn't be removed from the hanging rod. There was a notice on the television warning that removal of the cord and any movement of the set would automatically sound an alarm beyond guest control. The clock radio was bolted to the bed table. This was an establishment fully prepared to outfox thieves and scam artists. I put an ear to the wall, wondering who might be lurking in the room next to mine. I could hear snores rattle against the quiet. That was going to be restful later when I tried to sleep myself. I sat down on the edge of the bed and called the office, leaving my telephone number for Ida Ruth. While I was at it, I dialed my own answering machine, using the remote code to check for messages. None. My winsome long-distance message had netted me no response, which meant I'd have to go a-calling at some point. It was nearly midnight by now, and I could feel energy seeping out through my pores. Since I'd given up my day life to conduct my business by night, I'd noticed it was getting harder to predict the plunges into exhaustion. I longed to fling myself backward on the bed and fall asleep in my clothes. I roused myself before the notion became too seductive. In the bathroom, a printed notice warned of lingering drought conditions and begged motel guests to use as little water as possible. I took a quick, guilt-ridden shower, then dried myself on a towel as rough as a sidewalk. I set my duffel on the bed and pulled out clean underwear and pantyhose. Then I hauled out the Wonder Garment, my black all-purpose dress. Not that long ago, this article had been a fester with ditch water, smelling of mildew and assorted swamp creatures. I'd sent it to the cleaners several times in the intervening months, and by now it was as good as new, unless you sniffed really, really closely. The fabric represented the apex of recent scientific achievement, lightweight, wrinkle-defying, quick-drying, and indestructible. Several of my acquaintances rued this latter quality, begging me to dump the dress and add another to my wardrobe. I couldn't see the point. With its long sleeves and tucked front, the all-purpose dress was perfect. Well, adequate, for all occasions. I'd worn it to weddings, funerals, cocktail parties, and court appearances. I gave it a shake and undid the zipper, managing to step into the dress and my black flat simultaneously. No one would mistake me for a fashion plate, but at least I could pass myself off as a grown-up. According to the map and the address I'd been given, Joseph Ayers was living in Pacific Heights. I laid the map on the car seat and left on the interior light so I could see where I was going. I took a left on Divisadero and headed toward Sacramento Street. Once in the vicinity, I cruised the area. Even at this hour, the Ayers residence wasn't hard to spot. The house was ablaze with lights, and a steady stream of guests, both arriving and departing, were taking advantage of the varlet parking out in front. I turned my car over to one of the young men in black dress pants and white tuxedo shirts. There was a Mercedes ahead of me and a Jaguar pulling up behind. The front gate was open, and late arrivals were being steered around the side of the house toward the garden and back. Entrance to the party was being monitored by a man in a tuxedo, who viewed my outfit with visible concern.
"Good evening. May I see your invitation?"
"I'm not here for the party. I have a personal appointment with Mr. Ayers." His look said this seemed doubtful. However, he was being paid to smile, and he gave me the minimum wage's worth.
"Ring the front doorbell. One of the maids will let you in."
The house was surrounded by a narrow band of yard, generous by San Francisco standards, where houses were usually constructed smack up against each other. A high boxwood hedge had been planted just inside the wrought iron fence to maximize privacy. I moved up the brick walk. The grass on either side was tender green and recently mowed. The house was a looming three stories of old red brick, aged to the color of ripe watermelon. All of the leaded glass windows were framed in pale gray stone. The mansard roof was gray slate, and the entire facade was washed with indirect lighting. From the rear, I could hear the alcohol-amplified voices of numerous guests superimposed on the harmonies of a three-piece combo. Occasionally, a burst of laughter shot upward like a bottle rocket, exploding softly against the quiet darkness of the neighborhood. I rang the bell as instructed. A maid in a black uniform opened the door and stepped back to admit me. I gave her my name and told her Mr. Ayers was expecting me. She didn't seem to care one way or the other, and the black all-purpose dress apparently suited her just fine, thanks. She nodded and departed, allowing me a moment to take in my surroundings. The foyer was circular, with a black marble staircase curving up from the right. The ceiling rose a full two stories, and was capped with a cascading chandelier of gilt and flashing prisms. One of these days an earthquake would send the weight of it crashing, and the maid would be flattened like a cartoon coyote. Yet another man in a tuxedo appeared in due course and escorted me toward the back of the house. The floors